Okay, so what I'm going to talk about today is sort of an excursion that I have been doing together with Juan Pablo Paz, trying to put together the ideas that have been around for quite some time on quantum maps, on sort of how to deal with the problem of quantization of maps and how they are useful as models for studying, for example, chaos and many other properties. So, I mean, it's not really phase-based models, it's phase-based methods. I mean, this is a talk about things that can be useful. And the idea basically is that the process of quantizing a classical map, in which you have in mind a certain classical operation in phase space, and you try to represent it as a unitary operator, is not very much unlike what one has in mind when designing a unitary process that will do something useful, like factoring a number or something like that. So this is the basic idea. So I will first start with just very brief reminder. Classical maps, which preserve areas, that's important because that's what has the correspondence with unitary transformations, arise in many situations in classical as a stroboscopic section of Hamiltonian evolution in time-dependent systems, as Poincaré sections, or as scattering maps, where you map the incoming particle to the outgoing phase space. So there are also a whole other category of maps which are just simple models. They are designed to bring up some interesting feature without having to go through all the complication of integrating equations of motion. And these are just very simple maps that, for example, bring up the study of hyperbolicity, mixing behavior, symbolic dynamics, the role of periodic orbits. All these things can be studied in very, very simple models. So, a summary, classical maps which preserve areas are finite transformations of a certain phase space on itself. And to quantize them, one has two very different questions that has to be addressed. One is the kinematics, that means how do you design a Hilbert space that corresponds to the phase space that you have in your problem. And the second is dynamics, is once you have that Hilbert space, what operator will propagate whatever problem you have. Now, in quantum computing, is really this point A, I think, is reversed. One has large Hilbert space, and one is sort of left open in how to assign a phase space to that. Now, the fact that the Fourier transform is so ubiquitous in quantum computing indicates that the appropriate phase space is a torus. Now, if that's not, I don't think that is the only answer, and I will have some comments later on about that. Okay, so I will review what is the quantum mechanics on the torus, just to bring. So you see, if you have the usual phase space, which is unbounded in both p and q directions, then the eigenvalues of the p and q operators are continuous, and h bar that quantizes can take any real value. If you have a periodic coordinate, then the phase space is a cylinder. And then you can have a quantization in which q is continuous and periodic, but then the eigenvalues of momentum are just the discrete integers. That's just the Fourier analysis of periodic functions. If both p and q are periodic, like in a torus, which has both periodicities, then the quantization is different. The eigenvalues of the coordinate and the momentum are discrete, and most important, the value of h bar is restricted. So you can only have, you see, as the torus has a finite area, and you're going to quantize it with a certain number of states, then the ratio between the area of the torus and h has to be an integer. So if you normalize the area to 1, then h can only be the inverse of an integer. And then, well, then you have position and momentum eigenstates, and the transformation between them is the discrete Fourier transform. Yes?
And you made a mention earlier of what a great role of importance the Fourier transform plays in quantum computing. And here we've defined momentum as being the Fourier transform position, essentially the transformation between states.
Yeah.
Is that relation imposed by the canonical structure of P and Q, or is it possible to imagine operators that are one's a position, one's a momentum, that are not the Fourier transform relation?
Yeah.
It is possible to do that.
Well, this is the comment I wanted to make before. If you have a sphere, which is a phase space, and the usual it's the angular momentum sphere, then you have two. So if you want to impose the phase space, the Hilbert space is just the 2j plus 1 angular momentum states, but the Fourier transform there is like a rotation of pi over 2, and I know of no factorization of the pi over 2 Wigner V matrix. That, if that was available, then one could think of the discrete Hilbert space of as on a sphere. And so that is possible, but I don't know how to do it. And probably it cannot be done.
You have to tile the sphere somehow.
Yeah, and tiling the sphere is very hard. Yeah, that's the problem. So then the quantized torus can be assimilated to a discrete lattice, which has spanned by n position states or momentum states, and the transform between the two is just a discrete Fourier transform. So now the fact that can be factorized, and that's the neat thing about it, is that one can this is the basic algebra that's behind the fast Fourier transform algorithms. So you just write n as a combination using your, you first have to have N as a product of two integers. You N and K are split into a least significant integer and the more significant integer. That's the whole trick. So you divide this torus into boxes, and then you can think of the big torus of dimension n as the direct product of two smaller tori. That's the whole trick of the fast Fourier transform. So once you do that, then you write the exponential in this way, and then you interpret the transformation between momentum and position as now operating on two subsystems. So now you have two momentum lines, two coordinate lines, and the Fourier transform operate independently on both. Of course, there is a phase interaction between those two. The fact that then this procedure is recursive, then you can factor this, and then you can factor this, and then you go down all the way to the usual discrete Fourier fast Fourier transform algorithm. When you implement this on when n is a power of 2, then this scheme goes down to Fourier transform of dimension 2, which is just the Hadamard gate. This is not the only scheme. There are other things that happen when the two numbers are relatively prime. Then there's another way of dividing up the phase space. It's with sort of skew boxes. I didn't draw it because I found it complicated. But the main thing is that now the Fourier transform can be split into two non-interacting systems. So the phase interactions between these two have disappeared, but at the cost of taking very sort of complicated subsystems.
And how is that different from what you did before? What is the difference between the simple factoring and the sub-tori and that?
Well, because here you have you see, in here you have the two systems are in have interaction between them. In the other, they are independent.
Okay.
So depending on how you choose your sublattices, you can have a sort of a direct, a simple direct product of the two systems without interaction, or with this. These are called the Twiddle factors in the fast Fourier transform language.
What is determining the interaction here? Is this just a property of the phase space, or is this something about the Hamiltonian on it?
No, there's no Hamiltonian yet. Okay. This is just a transformation between spaces.
Another question. Are these more subspaces than subsystems? Is it total dimension? Because this is K1 plus K2, isn't it?
No. Times. So these are direct products of three different Hilbert spaces.
Okay.
Yeah, so in a way, so the general factorization of the Fourier transform is just into primes. So you have the equal primes that are so each prime has its own space. Of course, usually quantum computation is done in one of these subspaces. Uh, this is not the only way one can proceed to quantize the torus. The integer quantization corresponds to imposing periodic, strictly periodic boundary conditions on the torus. But in quantum mechanics, you can admit phases. So you can have the wave functions periodic up to a phase, and you can put a phase in momentum and a phase in coordinate. These are called Floquet angles. And then the quantization occurs for integer plus a fraction. So the lattice now is not on integers. But there is still a Fourier transform which is very similar. It just does not have the it's just not a product of two integers. It's a product of this kind. Now that can also be factored exactly in the same way. So you have the full thing breaks down into. The interaction is slightly different, and this is an interesting question. If you go down all the way to factors of two, you don't get the Hadamard here. You get another, I think it's a square root of the Hadamard up to a phase. So if you apply this scheme with for example half integer quantization or with any phase, then the whole scheme goes through again. But
do you need for this capital N to be a power of 2?
Yeah. I mean, it can be any product, but in particular a power of 2.
So a power of 2 is not necessary?
Not necessary.
To reduce it to the 2x2 matrix that
get. No. Well, I mean, if you have in the total N you have a power of 2, eventually you will go down to this.
Ah, okay. So for this you are using
the power of 2. Okay, so this is the quantization of the phase space. Now is how does one represent the quantum mechanics on these spaces as phase space? And this brings up the question of distributions. There are many. So
in general, when you have a map and you want to quantize, you have the freedom of the phase. Right, that's what you're saying. But
yeah.
Also, there's more freedom, or that's the only thing that.
For a torus, I think it's the only freedom. I mean, if you impose periodicity on both coordinates. So now distributions. So one wants to. One has now quantized. Has states in Hilbert space, and one wants to represent it in phase space, which is the torus. There are, if you're on the plane, it's well known, there are many, Wigner, Husini, Kirkwood, anti-Kirkwood, and I think there are others. And they are always related to how you do the ordering of P and Q. All of these have to be adapted to the fact that now you have boundary conditions. And this brings in some new features. For example, in the Wigner representation, you can write the Wigner representation of either an operator or a density matrix is just the trace of certain operators that depend parametrically on P and Q and the density matrix. These operators are, and we will see it later, it's displacement on the computational basis or on the coordinate basis, reflections, translations in the momentum basis, and phases. So if you put those, all this together, you get here a real function of on a discrete lattice. P and Q are discrete indices, and this is what a Wigner function looks like in the torus. There's also a way of doing Fusimi distributions. So if you are in the plane, the coherent states are just displacements of the harmonic oscillator ground state. And the important thing is they are analytic. And then the basic function is a Gaussian packet. And the Fusimi distributions is just the diagonal elements of the density matrix in this particular representation. On the torus, you have to periodicize the Gaussians, and then you get slightly more complicated things for the analytic representation of position eigenstates. You get the Jacobi functions, and this is the definition. They are just periodizations of Gaussians.
Now, is that unique, the choice of Jacobi functions, or are there other possibilities you can choose as the periodization of the Gaussian?
There are other possibilities. This one is very nice because it maintains the fact that the distribution is analytic on the torus, because this is an analytic function. There are other ways in which you can have discrete distributions which are similar to the, but those are very nice for numerical work. This is better for analytical work. What is brought about by the periodicity, I think is best seen here. This is the Wigner function of a coordinate state. This would be a computational state. What you see is this is the what one would expect for a position eigenstate, but then you get these things which are just the interferences between this state and its image on the periodicized torus. No? So, as he is around here, these are sub-Planck structures. I mean, if you you see, this is a structure which has, you see, this has area 1. This structure has area 1 over n, which is a Planck scale. And these little structures have scale 1 over n squared. No? And so each measurement of the, or if you determine the Wigner function in very contiguous places on the torus, and you find positive and negative values, that those are the kind of maximum interference that you can find.
But in this case, it has two parts of this high probability, where you can see the particle has to be there, and then in the middle of interference here, you have only one.
Well, because the other is in the image, in the image of the torus.
Yeah, but then you lose the classical.
This is what it looks like for a. You see, this is a Fusimi distribution of a coherent state. So that's what one expects. This has area 1 over n. You can fit pain of these packets in this area. This is the same thing in logarithmic scale, which shows the zeros. This is the, because this is an analytic function and it's doubly periodic, it has exactly n zeros on the torus. Now, this is now the Wigner representation of this state. And so you see in the Wigner, what you get instead of the zeros, what you get is interferences. No? Because this packet, as it is periodicized, it has an image here, an image here, an image here, and so on. So what these interference fringes are here are the interferences between this packet and its image. And they are exactly of the same scale as what Zurich has considered. Because, see, the maximum distance between two packets in this phase space is one. And so, yes?
There's a broken symmetry, there's symmetry breaking at the corner with the line of the zeros of the CV function. Is that just, no, to the left of that a little bit.
Here?
You've got a horizontal and vertical right there.
Is well, this is numerical. I mean, this is the fact that that here the Husini distribution is 10 to minus 5 or something, very small.
Okay.
So it's very hard to get exactly the
So there should be just the right corner?
Just, there should be two lines for a coherent state, if not the zero zero spread.
Can I ask a question about the preceding slide, where it was the simpler one, where you just had a single stripe?
Yeah.
Yes, that one. So the one on the left there.
This one.
So if you take the marginal, if you take a marginal by integrating horizontally, then you get something that oscillates.
Yeah.
But this I thought that it was supposed to, the Wigner function, when you take the marginal, you get the curve.
No, it doesn't oscillate. The values of this are exactly like this. So when you project the when both are positive, you get a positive result. When one is negative and the other is positive, you get zero.
So
at the odd positions, you get zeros, and the even position, you get the right distribution.
Okay.
Two n by two n grid.
Right. This is 2n by 2n grid.
Right, I understand now.
Okay. Now, so this is all description, say, of phase space features. Now we come to the dynamics. So what do you need? So now you have your phase space, and now you want to set up a unitary matrix that represents the evolution in this space. And you can do it in all the whatever representation, you can do it in the coordinate, in the momentum, in the mixed, whatever is convenient. If you want to this matrix to represent the classical transformation, when n becomes very large, you should get more and more classical, more and more closer to the classical regime. If you have symmetries, it would be good if they are preserved. And there is a general prescription for doing this, which comes from semi-classical physics, and that says that this unitary matrix, in whatever representation you choose, will have the structure of the exponential of a generating function divided by h bar with a very definite prefactor. No? So this is a recipe. It does not always result in a strictly unitary matrix. So one has to sometimes juggle it, and so the question of quantizing
it uniform in the semi-classical approximation.
So one expects this to be unitary when n is very large. So in many cases, one can find exactly unitary transformation that do this. But quantizing a map is not the same as quantizing a Hamiltonian, because there's no strict recipe like changing P into I ddQ or something like that. So you have, it's kind of an art. It's not really, there is no no method for doing it. So this is, but this is a very good guidance, because one knows that it has to be something like this if n is large.
But also for Hamiltonian, there is a guide to do it only in the XQ representation. Because if you take two other canonical representations and quantize them, it is the same only in the semi-classical limit.
Okay, okay. Yeah, no, but I mean...
For the quantization in X and P, that's just a law of nature. It's not something that that comes out of some logic.
No, I know, but I mean, one knows how to do it, and there is a definite prescription to do it.
Yeah, you have a momentum, you also know how to...
And your momentum, you work it out, you start from the XP representation, and you go there. But if you have angle action variables, and you quantize the angle and the action, they are quantifiable, but that's correct only in the leading order. It's not correct in general.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I mean, you have to define your. Yeah. Okay, so this is the how you quantize the simplest things, and these are exact. So translations are very easy. It's just a diagonal phase, as one knows. Shears are also easy. Shears are. You can shear in momentum or shear in coordinate. These are just, you see, they are diagonal, and you have a phase. This is A is related on how much you shear, and it's quadratic in N. So if you want to implement these on a quantum computer, you have essentially to be able to add a phase to the circuit, to whatever lines you have, depending on the value of the line. You can have nonlinear shears, and the other, these are all the transformations that have an exact quantization. These are the famous cut maps, the Arnold cut, not the Schrödinger cut, and they take the square, and they are the quantization of linear canonical transformations. So they are the things that in the plane are generated by quadratic Hamiltonians. No? And the quantization has the same form. It's the exponential of some quadratic form, which is related to the generating function of the transformation. No? So these are all easy to do, and actually easy to implement on an eventual quantum computer. Now you can put these together, put two shears together, and you get a kicked map. So kicked map is something that you do, say, kinetic energy evolution. You turn off the potential energy, then you turn off the kinetic energy and turn on the... So this is what the kicked map is. First, a translation in momentum translates the coordinate, and then there is a potential. So the quantization of this is also quite easy, because you do it in the mixed representation. So in the mixed representation, you see you go from momentum to coordinate, and then in the momentum basis, this is diagonal, it's just a phase. Then you have a Fourier transform, and then you have another phase which does the potential energy. No? And this is how all the kicked rotor, kicked spins, all the systems that are periodically driven have more or less this form.
Is it known how, when you cataloged your sort of fundamental maps, is it known how close you can get to the rotation transformation that's so important on the plane? I mean, on the plane, simple harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian is a rotation. And obviously you can't do that on a torus, but how close can you get to it?
Well, I can tell you, on the torus, on the torus, the harmonic oscillator Hamiltonian is the Harper's Hamiltonian. So it's just, you take U plus V. U is the translation on the coordinate basis. V is the translation on the momentum. So this is like E to the I, P, say, plus E to the minus I P. This is cosine P. This is cosine Q. And then
it's sort of the point where it looks like this, right? The opposite. The
of course, of course. And so they look like this. I mean, you have this, and then you have you have a hyperbolic point and an elliptic. So there are two solutions for this. So let's go here. Yeah. So now, if you take a kick map now, so you have kinetic energy, potential energy, Fourier transform, and now you break it up in this way, and then you can break it up in more subsystems. So so now you see, you have here, you have a unitary operation which is in a big Hilbert space. This is an example of the, what was it, the name? Fungibility, is that is that what? So you see, here you have the always the same. Actually, very simple. There's no entanglement. There's only interference in this vision of this unitary transformation. When you think of it represented in a multi-particle system, then you can think of what is the interference or the entanglement or the interaction between the different subsystems. So it is a way of looking at. And for example, when you do it for the Fourier basis, this line usually is a large scale. So you remember that there was a division in boxes. And this line was for the boxes, this line for the states inside the box. So you have, this line is the fine structures of the map, this line is the gross structure. So if you want to do any coarse graining or on the map, you do it on this line. No? And it gives...
What's coarse graining on the map?
What?
Can you be more specific? What do you call coarse graining on the map?
Well, if you see, what happens in this subsystem is what happens in the small scales or in the high, if you want, the high frequency components in the, no? If you average or interact with an environment or do whatever you want in this line, you are coarse graining this map.
Now, where is the boundary in the framework of the map between K1 and K2? Where is it on the map?
Well, remember I have
the Baker map. Where is the boundary there?
Well, the boundary is, you see, you have, I have divided the face space like this. So, an average over this, no, is an average over whatever happens in this line. Okay? Well, I guess I'll skip the cat maps because we have to sing. So this is, this is quite obvious. This is how you would do a simulation of a certain Hamiltonian. You just do exactly what you do when you do a path integral. You break up the Hamiltonian into small time steps, then you break it up again into a kicked map, which alternately does potential and kinetic kicks. You insert a whole lot of Fourier transforms in between, and then what this ends up is in a circuit which can be implemented on multi-bit system, in which you have a phase interaction, Fourier transform, another phase interaction, Fourier transform, and so on. So this is would be the implementation of any sort of Hamiltonian. And this, by the way, is the most efficient way of actually doing the calculation when you do a large scale, no? Now I come to the starting point of all this was the paper that Rüdiger and Carton wrote on the Baker map. I got very intrigued and started thinking about these things with their paper. So this is the Baker map. I mean, this is one of these models in which you have a very simple phase space structure. You quantize it and then use it to think, to explore what happens in the quantum version of the phase of the map. The quantization was done a long time ago. It's again done in the mixed representation, and what you do is you take the generating function of the map, so you follow the Van Vleck semi-classical procedure, but then you sort of arbitrarily set the matrix elements that are classically forbidden, you put them to zero, and you end up with a structure which has Fourier transform, and zero. If you represent this, this was Rüdiger's idea, if you represent this as a circuit, what you have is a very simple structure. You have one, this is now a qubit, this is just a 2x2 Hilbert space. Qubit that doesn't do anything, that gets transferred from coordinate to momentum, and the rest of the qubits are done, you do a Fourier transform. If you want to do the square in the mixed representation, then you have one map, you have to do a big Fourier transform, and then another, so this is would be the square of the map in the mixed representation. There are other maps that can be quantized in the same way. For example, this is the horseshoe. It's almost the same as before, except that instead of stacking this piece of phase space, stacking it like this, you turn it around. This is more what happens in real chaotic dynamics, in which the you have an unstable manifold folding on itself. No? So this is, the geometry of the folds is better done here than in the Baker map.
So are these unitary maps?
Yeah.
Then when you do the squeezing,
yeah,
presumably when you take a pair, I mean, I guess I'm thinking of this in a sort of a classical sense almost here. You take a pair of pixels that sit on top of each other and you must rotate them like that in order to be unitary. Otherwise, you wouldn't have...
No, you do a superposition. What happens is a superposition.
So it's a, this is a, you make a symmetric choice,
yeah,
whether to rotate, okay.
Yeah. So this is what this does. I mean, there are other options. One can think of. But so this map, this would be another different version. This would be the like the Baker, and you have to do an inversion here of on this line. So this is almost identical. We have studied this map too. Now, one application of this to more computational issues, one can think of the Grover search as a kicked map. Because remember the operator that is iterated in the Grover search is you change the phase, this is the oracle, so the oracle changes the phase of the unknown state that you're looking for, then Fourier transform, then this does the same thing for a standard coordinate space. So these two things are the same. So this is like a kicked map. This is the kinetic energy, which is very strange. This is the potential energy, which is also weird, because it's not continuous. So what you're taking is, you're, instead of adding a phase that is, say, quadratic in N or linear in N, what you're doing is you add the phase only to one state. So as a kinetic energy is quite complicated, but the structure is exactly the same. So then this, then you can look at it how this looks like. So this is how the, so here is the state you're looking for, which is a coordinate state. You start, these are the Wigner representations, you start with the momentum state, which is uniformly distributed over all the database, which is here. Then you iterate the map, and eventually you turn it into a pure coordinate state, no, at the location of the state that you are searching for. So this is sort of a phase space image of what's going on in the Grover search. Another, I think, potentially useful application of this, of these things, is what in semi-classical fields called the Muller rules. So what it is, I mean, if you are in the plane and you have quantized your map with the generating function, and then so depending on which representation you are, you can go Q, Q prime, P, P prime, etc. Then you find all the usual generating functions of classical mechanics. No? Now, the interesting thing is that if you want to now do the product of two unitary transformation, now you're going, you want to do this, then what you have to do is integrate over this variable. And if you do this integration by stationary phase, then you end up with exactly the same formula as before, but now with the generating function for the square of the map, or for the composition of the two maps. So, in a way, as long as you can do this approximation of stationary phase, you can commute the quantization operation with the propagation. No? So propagating a map is the same as propagating and then quantizing is the same as quantizing and then propagating. Of course, this is not exact, and it only works if you are in the classical limit. Now, if you translate this into this language of circuits, then one can say, well, suppose I want to implement the square of twice a certain operation. Then I have to implement it on a certain number of gates, and that will be more and more difficult and very... But if I have a way of saying, well, if I have many qubits and the transformation is semi-classical, then I can simplify the circuit. I want to give an example, again, on the based on the Baker transformation. You have, I want to do the square of the Baker. I have in mind implementing this on some computer. So what I have to do is a Fourier transform, do nothing. This thick line is a lot of qubits. No? So I have to do a big Fourier transform on this. Using this way of breaking up the Fourier transform into subsystems, I can open up this, then I can open up this, then I can open up this, and I end up with a big complicated circuit, which would require, you see, this is a Hadamard, this is a Hadamard. These are phase, sort of phases that depend on the state of this qubit and the state of all these qubits. No? So this is a sort of something that should be implemented if one wants to end up with this. Now, I can use my knowledge of the fact that the Baker map corresponds to a classical one to drastically simplify this circuit and make sure that so here this would be one way. This is I have taken the quantized map and propagated it exactly. Now what I know is that if this n is large, this map behaves semi-classically, and then I can first propagate classically and then quantize. If I do that, the circuit becomes extremely simple. So this, so you see the difference, this map is obtained by propagating the Baker map twice and then quantizing. So you see, the only thing you have to do is you have to take two qubits, the two most significant qubits from the momentum, and shifting them to the position. This is just like symbolic dynamics. I don't think I have time to explain it, but I will show a picture which will... But you see that the two circuits are quite similar. You have to compare this one with this one. Now, what it means is that all these sort of interactions sort of are non-important, are not very important for the operation of the map. If I eliminate all these, then these three Fourier transforms become only one. These cancels with these cancels with this. There's no more interaction and you get this.
So does it sort of say that phases don't matter?
For this?
Yeah.
For this thing.
I mean, but whenever you go from quantum to classical way, semi-classical way, is it always
no
the same rule where
no, 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 no. This, okay. Let me show what is the difference between the two maps. Now, this is a picture of the exact square of the map. So you see, and this is the propagator. This is the Fourier, these are the Fourier blocks. You see these patterns are just the phases of the Fourier blocks. Now, what happens is that these are the classically allowed regions. In those regions, the propagator is complex, it oscillates rapidly, and these are the classically allowed regions. These regions in which you see the amplitude is very smooth and decaying, these are the classically forbidden regions.
What's the color coding?
Let's see. The color coding is it's exactly like there should be a little no, there isn't here. So these are the phases of the propagator. Each pixel is one matrix element.
So these are phases, not amplitudes.
There is a coding for blue is minus one and yellow is plus one. So these are real. Okay. These are complex. These are real and it's very small. No, and these are complex and large. The modulus is not represented here. So this is just the phase. But the point is that what has happened is that because the map is discontinuous, there are diffraction effects. And so what all these interactions that I took out were just the diffraction effects in the map. So if I were to quantize the square of the map, I would just get zero all over here, Fourier transform, like this. So this would be this map. Of course, this whole thing is this. Now, as you go to higher and higher dimensions, the diffraction effects are narrower and narrower. They don't disappear, no, but they are limited to very small regions of phase space. So but in all other aspects, you can very well replace this exact map by just the simple one in which you have Fourier transforms in the four blocks. So this is one technique.
So is there something like an Ehrenfest-Stein that you can define? I mean, it would seem that as you go forward and do, exact quantum evolution or just classically, and then at what point you run out of
accuracy? That will be. I mean, propagating many times, will be a whole. I mean, finding out what goes on for long times. That depends on the map. Depends if the map is chaotic, as in this case. This I have not touched at all. I mean, this is.
I think it relates to that point. I was going to say, if when you do your compression, you choose to instead of rotating one way or the other, to do a superposition, then you're violating strict area preservingness because you take a single dot and you spread it out among two, and so that's violating the classicality condition. And so I think that's where the error comes from, and the difference between composing the map twice, composing the quantized map twice, or quantizing the double map, right? But that error is going to grow exponentially with the number of times you compose the map before.
Sure. No, of course. I mean,
So that sort of answers Wojciech's question. This is logarithmic.
But this is
it's not chaotic.
Yes.
This is because the map is chaotic. Yeah. So I mean, this is knowledge that here I have not used at all. I mean, just sort of that will come in if you want to propagate a lot of times. That will come in. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that's liable to happen though, even with non-chaotic maps. If, for instance, your map was a translation by less than one grid space, that would also.
So that you cannot do. How do you do that?
Right.
How do you do that?
You have to smear out. You have to violate area preservingness.
Okay.
I'm just going to make the point that this is really a question of how valid the semi-classical approximation is, right? This discussion.
Yeah, no, I mean, the thing
much
is
much longer than a log time.
Well, this, I don't want to get into the, that's more technical and more related to the specifics of the map. Here, I'm just saying that the square of the map, fixed time, can be approximated in the semi-classical limit. That means when n becomes large with fixed t, I can do this for any power of the map. What I cannot do is the opposite, is to keep sort of propagate the map with fixed value of h bar with for long times. So this is okay. Let me come briefly to the last point, and this is sort of more in line of how these techniques could be really useful. We have seen that the Wigner function on the torus was the trace of this operator. This is a unitary operator which combines a little bit all these quantizations that we have been doing. This is a translation in the coordinate spaces, this is a reflection, this is a translation in the momentum basis, and this is just a phase. What I didn't show it, but this is what it is, the Wigner function of whatever you put here, the Wigner function is defined as the trace of rho with this operator. This circuit, in which you have one qubit started in a pure state zero Hadamard, and you do a control on all these things. If you measure here sigma z, what you get is the Wigner function of corresponding to this q and this p. So each value of the Wigner function can be obtained sort of with a circuit of this kind.
It's a bit of information.
What?
What's R?
Excuse me?
What's R?
It's a reflection. So, of course, you get, if you want the full tomography of this state, you have to do 4n square measurements. No? But again, these each of these measurements is one sub-Planck cell, if you want. And this is
each measurement is on an ensemble to get the average.
Oh yeah, you have to get the average here. Yeah, but it's only in one bit. No.
On many copies of the
bit. On many copies. Yeah.
But if you read it once, you get a number. And you're saying that that number you don't believe. You have to average over many runs of this, or?
No, many runs of this. Yeah, you have to run. You have to measure the.
Because you're going to get an answer of 0 or 1. Yeah. And exactly. That's a value can be anything. Yeah.
Right. But then you have to do many things, and then you get a positive or negative. Yeah. And that's the value of the Wigner function. This is what. Unfortunately, I didn't. I couldn't get the colors on this, so I cannot show. But you see, this is the measure, an actual measurement in an NMR situation. We have two qubits, so that's the phase space has dimension 4. The phase space has dimension 8x8, no, 64. So there are 64 cells that determine the Wigner function of this state. So what we have done is take a coordinate state, no, and this coordinate state has been measured in all the 64 places, and unfortunately these are all the same color. These are alternate colors. You have to believe on the web they are in color, so you can
they are fingers from your preprint.
Yeah. So, but the thing is that, so you see two contiguous measurements here. One is positive and one is negative. So this is, if you want, it's a sub-Planck measurement. Of course, the Planck here is very meager, so it's not or huge. Yes?
On that diagram, so one of those dark lines is the state, and the other dark line is the interference pattern at the other side of the torus. So why am I seeing an interference pattern between the state and the interference pattern?
Because of the periodicity that you have imposed. Because you are using the discrete Fourier transform, which has aliasing, and
but that didn't show up on your theoretical.
Oh yeah,
the transform of the first.
Every state is a Schrödinger cat here. Right? Every state is a Schrödinger cat.
Well, I'm not sure. That I wouldn't go so far.
No, it's just an interference line.
It's a huge
Schrödinger. Yeah. Jumped
right off to infinity.
Yeah.
Quantum at all. Periodically continued forever.
Yeah. Okay.
Well. Theoretically, I don't see why there should be interference between the solid line and the interference line.
No,
theoretically, there is. I think you have a lattice which, I mean, a lattice which runs up to infinity.
We got a lattice of states that runs up to infinity in both x and t. So
everything's very, very sharp.
I'm totally confused now. That's okay.
Robin's talking about the little gray squares that show up.
Yeah,
that is a little.
No, this. So this was. So we measured something like that.
Right.
Except that it's. So this line is thick. This line is.
So what are the little gray squares in between? Yeah.
Oh, those are errors. Those are.
No. It's causing it.
Here? No. These are very small values, positive or negative, that should be zero.
Okay, but in the slide, the graph, above, yeah, a very regular pattern of errors, right? It's checkerboarded.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that's true.
I'm curious if there's a good explanation for that.
No.
Okay.
I don't know. I didn't do the measurements. So the last thing is a spectroscopy. It's essentially more or less the same circuit, except that now you do here a more complicated thing with the Fourier transform and the control, so you assume that you can propagate the map many times, not controlled by this line, and then what you get is the here again you get the Fourier transform of the propagator traced with the with whatever you put here, so that's the response function of the map. So that shows the eigenvalues, no? And I mean, if one can do all this, I'm not. But this is a way of doing spectroscopy of this map. And I don't have an actual measurement, but it's just an observation of what would happen. This is the spectrum of the Baker map for this value of n, so this would be like seven qubits, and qubits, which will be the situation. If you don't have too many qubits on this line, you have only three or four, then you cannot propagate the map very far. So what you get instead of a full density of states, resolving the individual states, what you get is a smoothed density of states with oscillations. No? This is what you get. And what's important is that would then reflect this curve here comes from another, but it is related to the periodic orbits of the map, to the short periodic orbits of the map. So a very smoothed spectral density for the map computed in this way would give information on the periodic orbits of the map. No? So this curve is related to the actions and the instabilities of the periodic orbits. So this is, and I guess I'll stop. This is all.
If you take one of these states, if you take a position eigenstate, then it's fairly clear that a displacement by the subline structure in any direction makes a state into an orthogonal state. Is it? The question is, can one check it for more general pure states? And because it must be fairly possible to do it either analytically or maybe look at.
Well, the thing is, if you have a general Wigner function on the torus, say one that would come from an evolution or something, it's just positive and negative values all over the place.
Sure.
So anything that you measure anywhere will be large positive, large negative. I think that's what, well, not large.
But that's a question, right? The question is how quickly, if you move it slightly, how quickly would it go down? Right, because in this case, if you move it along the line, it would kind of oscillate between 0 and 1, 0 and 1, 0 and 1. If you move it in any other way, by less periodicity of the lattice, it's going to just dive to 0, I think.
Maybe if you move it along, you mean if you move it in momentum?
If you move it in position by 1 square, it's going to go to 0. If you move it by 2 squares, it's going to go back up to 1.
A position eigenstate?
Yeah.
What's n?
Sorry?
What is n?
N is the, 2 n is, it's what was it? Not even this picture.
In general, if n is 0.5 or something, then you're going to get, it's going to go to 0 and it's going to stay at 0.
Not if you choose a specific translation, right?
Yeah. I think that that statement is only for generic states, which will.
Well, I don't know if it's true for generic states. I think it is true for generic, but it might be interesting to check whether the states into which you evolve this would have that property, or whether one can find interesting counterexamples.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be.
I have a question. I'm sure it's quite unique. I hope you can help me with that. There's sort of a basic point I'm missing, which is why this torus geometry is the appropriate one to think about. So if I think about trying to do things with quantum computing, I would think the natural structure is to think about a bunch of qubits, and each qubit, the natural geometry is a sphere, and
it's not the way. The thing is, I think the torus and the sphere coincide for dimension 2. So the Hadamard on dimension 2 is both the Fourier transform and the rotation by pi over 2. But that's not the case when you go to higher dimension. So I think I would like to be able to do the sphere to do the fast, that sort of a fast rotation, because that would then do what you say is think of each subsystem as a sphere and not as a torus.
Right.
In dimension two, I cannot, I mean, it's the same thing.
Okay.
Next.
Can you think of your Grover search algorithm? You mentioned you wrote down a quantum kicked version. Can you think about a classical map that does the analogous classical thing?
Well, it is a composition of two shears, but they are very, very strange shears.
So can you use your Van Vleck trick to reduce circuits?
No. Well, that not that one, because it's very well, I don't know, I mean, it's very diffractive in a way, because you are doing something to a very tiny portion of phase space which are not, you are not doing to the rest, so it's like a point defect. Yeah.
Like, where's this?